Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. May I remind you that America's greatest directors made life-changing films during World War II, and they did it entirely without cell phones. Please silence them for the duration of this event as well. Thank you. It is my particular pleasure this evening to introduce Mark Harris. Ever since I read his first book, Pictures at a Revolution, I've been going around pushing it on all my friends and telling them hilarious stories about Rex Harrison, whether they wanted to listen or not. Luckily, my friends are a lot of film buffs. If you want to understand not only the movies of 1967, but how America thought of itself in that turbulent year, I can't recommend anything better than reading Pictures at a Revolution. Mr. Harris's new book, Five Came Back, provides an equally clear lens for viewing the major American films made between about 1937 and 1947, and somehow it manages to feel just as comprehensive as the book that concentrated on one year alone. I warn you, though, if you want to read it, it will take you weeks while you drop everything and watch or rewatch Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Maltese Falcon, Mrs. Miniver, They Were Expendable, The Best Years of Our Lives, and several dozen other great or at least historically revealing movies. Thank heavens for video and DVD, right? I defy you to resist watching them. And if you read the book, I guarantee you will see them all, and maybe even the war itself, with new eyes. Please join me in welcoming Mark Harris.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. I am not accustomed to lecturing, so I'm going to try to do this a little bit extemporaneously, and please bear with me. I'll talk for about a half hour. I'm telling you that in advance so that nobody panics. And then I'll be really happy to take questions about any aspect of the book. I wanted to start out just by telling you a little about what brought me to research and write Five Came Back. My father was a World War II veteran. He joined up when he was 17, lying about his age, and he served in Burma in the Signal Corps, not very near the action. He never fired a gun. He was never fired at. He didn't see combat, but it was very clear to me from an early age that the war defined him, defined his sense of who he was as a man, defined his place in the world after the war. And like most veterans of World War II, he liked to tell war stories. And I did not like to listen to them. When I was a little kid, I found his stories alienating and frightening. I didn't understand growing up. I was born in 1963, and I didn't understand growing up in New York City in the late 60s and early 70s, a world in which a 17-year-old boy would leave home to go to another country and risk being killed or captured. I didn't understand the idea of a war that would change the lives of everyone in the United States, and his stories and the passion with which he talked about them frightened me a little bit. So I tried not to listen. And I think that deciding to work on Five Came Back was, for me, a way of investigating my own aversion to this topic, because that aversion persisted long after I grew up, long after my father died. I became a film buff and a film historian and a film journalist, but although my tastes and my appetites ranged throughout all of film history, that period of 1939 to 1945, and particularly movies about World War II that were made during World War II, were something that I became more and more conscious that I was staying away from. And I think my journalistic instinct to go learn about something that I had resisted learning about started to kick in, and that's what brought me to the story of these directors. I also, in 2009, when I started to think about this book, was very aware that we were coming close to the end of our a decade in which we were involved in two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that 30 or 40 years from now, if future film historians or cultural historians wanted to understand those wars and their effect on the American public through movies, they would have very little on which to draw. You could probably count on the fingers of both hands the number of major Hollywood movies that have engaged with these wars, even indirectly. And I was fascinated by the contrast between our time and World War II, when in 1942 and 1943, an average of 3 to 4 movies a week were released by the major studios that had some war content. Either they were explicitly about the war, combat movies, or they were romances or spy films or service comedies or adventures or stories of international intrigue or melodramas that used the war as a backdrop. But whatever they were, it was not possible to be a moviegoer during World War II without having some aspect of the world reflected back to you on screen. And that drew me to another big difference between that era and this one, which was that, of course, in those years, the different ways in which people could take in the war were very limited. If you wanted to know about the war, you really had 3 choices. You could listen to the radio, you could read newspapers or magazines, or you could go to the movies, which 80 million Americans did at least once a week. And if you wanted to see the war, of course, that let out radio and print. Your only choice was to go to the movies. I was fascinated by the idea of the movies and movie theaters as both a place to escape the realities of the world and to be confronted by them. Because, of course, going to the movies in, say, 1942 meant not only seeing a double feature, it meant seeing newsreels and news footage. It was a way to see the war and a way to experience the war week by week in both non-fictional and fictional form. And in fact, for some of the big events of the war, for instance, D-Day, many theaters across the country would advertise outside 10 days, 9 days, 8 days until first footage of D-Day, the same way that a coming attraction of a major feature would be advertised. So how to tell that story, how to tell the story of that time and that very different country, the window into it to me felt like these men who suspended their lives in Hollywood really at the height of their powers to accept officers' commissions in the Army or the Navy and give the next 3 or 4 years of their lives to service as documentarians or propagandists. And I want to tell you a little bit about each of these 5 men just to give you a very brief understanding of where they were culturally when Pearl Harbor happened. John Ford, the first of my directors and the only one who served in the Navy and not the Army, had this extraordinary run of success in the 3 years before Pearl Harbor. He had directed 7 movies. That was another extraordinary difference between now and then. Directors worked fast. These movies were made usually in a matter of 4 to 8 weeks. And you could, in 1940 or 41, go from the conceptual stage of commissioning a script to shooting a movie, to editing a movie, to test screening a movie, to re-editing a movie as a result of the test screening, to having it in theaters within a space of 6 months. That was very, very typical. And equally typical was the possibility of revising that movie to reflect world events, sometimes as little as 4 weeks before the movie was in theaters. Today, if a movie goes from concept to completion in 2 years, that's very, very fast. And often it's 10 or 15 or 20. So Ford, in the years before Pearl Harbor, had made Stagecoach, Young Mr. Lincoln, Drums Along the Mohawk, The Grapes of Wrath, and How Green Was My Valley. that's literally just from 1939 to 1941. And he also managed to squeeze in those years, an adaptation of Tobacco Road and a film called The Long Voyage Home, which was an adaptation of Eugene O'Neill's Glen Cairn plays, the Seafaring Quartet. So it's funny because now we think of John Ford as a director of Westerns, but with the exception of Stagecoach, his great Westerns were made after the war. Going into the war, John Ford was seen as, in many ways, Hollywood's social conscience. The Grapes of Wrath, in particular, was a really significant progressive statement, and he also infused How Green Was My Valley with a pro-union message. If Ford was at that moment the most successful American director, critically, Frank Capra was the most successful financially. He was the first millionaire director. He was on the cover of Time magazine before the war with the headline Columbia's Gem, because he had really single-handedly kept Columbia Pictures, which was at that time a small studio, afloat. He had won Academy Awards in 1934, 1936, and 1938 for directing It Happened One Night, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, and You Can't Take It With You. And he followed You Can't Take It With You with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's funny because Capra was known, largely because of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, as a spirited populist, a champion of the common man. He was actually a conservative Republican who hated labor unions, boasted that he never voted for FDR once in four elections, and at one point flirted seriously with making a film biography of Mussolini, which was to have been written by Il Duce himself, until the head of Columbia wisely talked him out of it. John Huston was the youngest of the five directors I write about. He had worked as a screenwriter for several years on movies like Jezebel and Wuthering Heights and Juarez, often as a rewrite man, not as the first credited screenwriter. But shortly before Pearl Harbor in 1941, he was given the chance to direct his first movie, The Maltese Falcon. And that was, as instantly beloved a movie back then as it is now. And it opened the door for Huston to pursue a full-time directing career. But he was only able to make about 1¾ more movies before he realized that he had misread his Army induction papers and that he was due in Washington immediately. So he made a not very good melodrama called In This Our Life, and then he made a movie that was intended to reunite him with Humphrey Bogart and Mary Astor and Sidney Greenstreet called Across the Pacific, and had to drop it very abruptly and hand it off to another director to go to war. William Wyler was the only Jewish director of the five directors I write about, and like Frank Capra, he was an immigrant, a first-generation American. Capra was from Sicily. Wyler was from a town called Mulhouse, which at various times in his youth had been either a French town or a French town under German occupation. He was known as a really sophisticated and meticulous craftsman. I think of not only really beautiful movies from the mid-30s like Dodsworth, which is just absolutely worth revisiting if you haven't seen it in a long time, but particularly in his pre-war work of the what I would think of as the Bette Davis trilogy of Jezebel, The Letter, and The Little Foxes. People joked and sometimes did not joke that he would do 40 or 50 takes if that's what it took to get it right. I don't think you would have necessarily discerned a really an avid taste for social or political realism in those early movies, but Wyler was in fact quite passionate about what was going on in the world, and at the time Pearl Harbor happened, he was halfway through making Mrs. Miniver, which is a fascinating example of a movie that changed on a dime in a way because of Pearl Harbor. Mrs. Miniver is, I don't know how many of you have seen it, but it's the story of a lovely middle-class, but really upper-middle-class British family in a kind of idyllic British village who are profoundly affected by the start of the war in Europe. They lose friends, they lose neighbors, they lose family, they even at one point lose the roof over their heads. Mrs. Miniver was conceived before America's entry into the war as an expression of solidarity with the British. And it's really, to the extent that it's a piece of propaganda, it's a beautifully told piece of propaganda about how the unity of a family can stand in for the unity of a village, and the unity of a village can stand in for the unity of a country and the erasure of class distinctions among various peoples in order to pursue a common goal and fight a common enemy. After Pearl Harbor, the meaning of that movie to American audiences became something very different. You know, it was no longer an expression of sympathy. The Miniver family now stood in for American families as well as for British families. And as an example of courage that American movie-going audiences who really embraced the film could pursue. The script also changed as a result of Pearl Harbor. The film ends with a sermon about fortitude and the importance of endurance that was originally supposed to quote a psalm rather benignly. After Pearl Harbor, it was rewritten to become a more Churchillian, explicitly Churchillian, call to unity and fighting spirit, which was slightly odd to put in the pulpit, but very, very effective. And the last shot of Mrs. Miniver, which is really exquisite, pans up from the pulpit to the hole in a bombed-out British church's roof through which you see Allied planes flying overhead, you know, taking the war to the enemy. The last director I write about and the last to go into the war was George Stevens, who was known as a really skilled director of the most escapist movies that Hollywood had to offer. Comedies like Vivacious Lady, musicals like Swing Time, the very first Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy pairing, Woman of the Year. He was the last into the war. He was also the last out of the war. And was in many ways the most traumatized by the war. I want to talk just a little bit about the conflict these men faced, which is one of the things I really wanted to explore in the book, because it was sort of a three-way conflict. As artists who were incredibly skilled in what they did in Hollywood, they obviously wanted to make either propaganda movies for the American home front audience or training films, which is what Capra really did with the Why We Fight series. Those films were intended for servicemen and not for public consumption. As artists, they wanted to make the best movies they possibly could make, the most effective, narratively powerful movies they could make. As patriots, they wanted to do everything they could to help the war effort. And as men, they were interested in telling the truth. And so it was not only often a conflict of interest, it was a conflict of three interests, where truth crashed into artistic integrity, and both of those crashed into patriotism. Which of those things won and which lost, and which director made truth a priority and which director made helping the war effort a priority, is something that if you choose to read the book, I think you will find interesting. because the answer is very different for each of the men, and what these men chose as their answer, I think, affected them really profoundly for the rest of their lives and their careers. And I want to give you just a few examples of what these issues were. And when I wrote about them, I tried to not fall prey to, I think, two dangers that anyone writing about history can face. The first danger is looking at the decisions that these men made through sort of smug 2014 goggles, to sort of judge them and their ethics of filmmaking based on 75 years of knowledge that they didn't have. But I think it's an equal danger to just issue a blanket exoneration to all of these men on the premise that the times were different. Yes, the times were different, but, for instance, the ethics of falsifying something in a documentary and then passing it off to the general public as reality were as relevant in 1938 and 1943 as they are today. And the men involved knew that and made their choices in that context. So I'll give you the worst example of what happened and then a couple of more ambiguous examples of what happened, and then I think the best example of what happened. The worst example is a film called Tunisian Victory, which was a documentary made, commissioned in the anxious wake of a very successful British documentary about the North African campaign called Desert Victory. The Americans felt humiliated by Desert Victory because, first of all, it was a stronger piece of battlefield action filmmaking and propaganda than anything the Americans had yet produced. And the Americans knew that. What they didn't know at the time was that Desert Victory contained some reenactments. They were very skilled reenactments, but they were reenactments. One of the problems with Desert Victory, as far as the War Department was concerned, was that it was not only a better movie than the Americans were making, it strongly suggested that the British were entirely responsible for the success in North Africa and really short shrifted the American contribution to it. When the Americans confronted their British allies, what the British told them in sort of blunt terms was, "You didn't have any good footage. So how could we include your work when we had so much good footage of our own?" Frank Capra, who was stationed for most of the war in Washington and was really the hub of the war effort, he was, more than any of these directors, in charge of commissioning the films that were going to be made, brought in two of his colleagues, John Huston and George Stevens, to assist him in falsifying footage for Tunisian Victory, the American response to Desert Victory. And Stevens and Huston, in the name of patriotism and also in the name of following orders, did it, but with great chagrin. George Stevens was in Algiers at the time. He had, to his great frustration, gotten to Algiers just in time to miss the victory. He had gone to shoot the North African campaign there, and he got there, and everybody was relaxed and drinking because it was over. So with the Army's full cooperation, he was handed a bunch of tanks and a bunch of idling American soldiers, and they re-liberated town after town, rolling through towns that had already been freed, getting villagers to come out and cheer or run away from the tanks, and generally give the impression that cameras had been with the Allies all the way. John Huston's task, which was to complete this movie for Capra, was even worse. He was brought by Capra to the Mojave Desert, to a training center that was used for the Army to basically acclimate incoming GIs to desert conditions, and handed a bunch of, I think they were P-29 flyers, and dummy tanks, which were basically steel frames with canvas pulled over them and shot from a great distance. He shot basically American planes bombing American tanks, disguised as enemy tanks, in the Mojave Desert, which was disguised as North Africa. He then went to film the air war in Orlando, Florida, which was such a misadventure that Houston describes himself as being in the air and kind of directing the action, and saying to his cameraman, "The enemy's coming in at 2 o'clock," and the cameraman would stop and look at his watch. So this left Houston and Stevens with a really, really sour taste in their mouths about reenactment. And I should note that this was not something that all of the directors faced. William Wyler, for instance, when he was in England making Memphis Belle, the story of a flying fortress, one of the great bombers that he flew missions in over occupied France and Germany. Wyler's colleagues strongly urged him at one point, when he was not getting the access he wanted, to just give up and do this as a series of reenactments on a soundstage. He refused, and in fact eventually flew 5 missions. He and 2 of his fellow cameramen were able to shoot in these bombers, so that every piece of footage you saw was actual film from inside a bomber on a mission. And although the soundtrack had to be recreated because it was just impossible in these unpressurized planes to shoot sound film, the equipment also wasn't there to do that. Wyler insisted that when the Memphis Belle's mission was over and the 10-man crew came to the United States for its victory tour, that the 10 men be brought to California to do the soundtrack themselves, so that even though the soundtrack was a recreation, it was a recreation with the original men saying what they had originally said. So I bring that up only to note that it was very possible for a filmmaker to put a premium on scrupulous accuracy and to act accordingly and to still make an extraordinary movie. Houston and Stevens did not have that option on Desert Victory, and it's interesting to me that they went in 2 rather different directions after Desert Victory in terms of their war work. Houston went on to make an extraordinary and troubling battle film called San Pietro, which was about the liberation of an Italian village. Again, like Stevens in North Africa, Houston got to the action too late. The village had already been retaken, and it was impossible to shoot the scenes that Capra had asked him to shoot, which were scenes of the village being retaken and joyous villagers emerging from their hiding places with artisanal cheeses and freshly baked bread and jugs of wine to greet the American GIs, and little kids running up and hugging the soldiers. The town was bombed to bits, was completely empty, there were no villagers to be found, and it was full of German booby traps. So Houston, with the full consent and enthusiasm of the army, recreated the Battle of San Pietro. The movie is entirely, except for one shot, recreations. He did it on location, where the battle had actually happened, and he did it with soldiers. They weren't actors. They were soldiers. And this is, to me, a very, very troubling episode in the history of American propaganda, because the movie was not only a reenactment, it was a reenactment that was passed off as fact with the worst set of lies about this that the Army ever told. They issued press releases to newspapers explaining that Houston and his men were so brave that they had actually gone ahead of the soldiers on the front to find the best angles to capture them, which was their way of explaining the telltale sign of a reenactment, which is that the camera always seems to be ahead of the advancing soldiers. But the really interesting thing was that Houston didn't see this as a game. He had seen battle. He had seen the fields and woods littered with the corpses of American soldiers as he was approaching San Pietro for the first time, and he wanted very, very much to create a battle film that was battle as he had seen it. So San Pietro is not good propaganda in that it's not particularly triumphalist. It is a stark, brutal movie where you see these soldiers looking haggard and exhausted and advancing not in a really gung-ho way, but step by fitful step. You see what these bombs have done. You see the danger that they're in. When a bomb goes off, which is, of course, a grenade that Houston directed to go off, the camera shakes as if the cameraman is startled. It goes out of focus. That was something that hadn't been done in films before. I went to the National Archives and viewed the outtakes of San Pietro, and it's fascinating to see that Houston systematically discarded anything that looked fake, anything that looked stagey. So he passed off this complete contrivance, but he did it in the service of trying to show what a battle really looked like in a way that Americans had not seen before. And he never admitted it, which is interesting because he was absolutely open in later years about his deceptions in the earlier movie and his great distaste for them. But with San Pietro, I don't think that, and I'll never know this, but I don't think he didn't admit it because he was ashamed of what he had done. I think he didn't admit it because the movie was real to him. And it was, for him, a case of the means justifying, or the ends justifying the means. That's something I think we can still debate about. But it's troubling that San Pietro was passed off for many decades as an example of battlefield realism. By contrast, George Stevens, who was present at D-Day, who followed American and French troops through France to the liberation of Paris, which he filmed, and who really did capture joyous villagers coming out of their hiding places and throwing flowers at jeeps and hugging soldiers. All of the images that Capra really wanted, he captured unstaged. Stevens dabbled in fakery one last time, but it was fakery that actually changed history. One of the things he filmed on the day that Paris was liberated was the official surrender of the occupying general. He filmed it inside a railway station, which is where it took place. And he was worried that it wouldn't come out on film because the light was too low. So he ordered the victorious French commander and the deposed Vichy general to come outside and redo the surrender in natural light. When the surrendering general protested, Stevens, who did not speak very much French, just said, "C'est la guerre, général, c'est la guerre." So that was a case where I don't know if you could say that, I don't know whether you should say if Stevens faked history or rewrote history on the spot, because that second take, the outdoor take, was the surrender that moviegoers around the world saw. However, what I wanted to note was that the end of Stevens's war experience was that he was one of the first American filmmakers into the camps in Germany. He famously filmed Dachau in the days after it was liberated. And that footage, which still exists, and 95% of which was much too raw and brutal to be shown to American home front audiences, is shattering. And it is, in many ways, the most truthful footage that an American director shot on the ground in the war. And what's extraordinary to me is that Stevens, going into the camps, instinctively knew immediately that his job had changed, and he knew it without orders. He knew that he was no longer a propagandist, and that he was no longer even a documentarian. He was a gatherer of evidence. His job was to film everything he saw. And what's remarkable is that even though he had many men working under him, he chose to film the worst things himself. He was the one who went into the crematoriums. He was the one who went into the boxcar. The images that we in later decades came to know as some of the most searing Holocaust images to come out of the war were shot by his hand, largely, because he felt that he could not ask his men to go do that. Stevens was so traumatized by that experience that he, not just traumatized by what he saw, but traumatized by what he felt it brought out in himself. He said that the thing he could never shake was not the horror that he saw, but the revulsion that he felt at the horror. He said that he felt he had discovered the Nazi in any human being, because when some wretched, lice-covered supplicant was grabbing at him, he pulled away. He reared back, and he said that just in his few days at Dachau, or a few weeks at Dachau, he understood how easily one could become non-human, and how one could treat other people as non-humans. He never made a comedy again. He took the footage that he had shot and stayed in Germany for months after the war, compiling it into 2-hour-long evidentiary films that were used at the Nuremberg trials. And the 20 defendants at Nuremberg actually had to sit and watch Stevens' movies. So that is where his war story and his journey toward truth ended. And I've left a great deal about these five men out, which is in the book, but I think I'm going to perhaps stop there, and I'd be really happy to answer any questions you have. Yes? Yeah, the question is, what's the story with Frank Capra and D-Day? Were some of the films lost? And yes, Frank Capra, I mean, it's interesting. George Stevens was in charge of the army effort to film at D-Day, and John Ford, who knew Stevens and respected him, was in charge of the Navy effort to film at D-Day. So they were they worked together. But Capra, who was back in Washington, was overseeing the whole thing and was in charge of kind of creating a master plan, obtaining all the footage, and cutting it into newsreel-ready segments for consumption by the American public. The D-Day effort was the most massive and heavily planned filmmaking effort of the war. There were literally hundreds of cameras and dozens of cameramen. Many of the cameras were fixed cameras that were attached to the front of the landing craft and rigged to start shooting automatically. Many of the other cameras were held by cameramen. Really miraculously, none of the Army cameramen were killed at D-Day. However, almost all of the footage was destroyed. I shouldn't even say footage. Most of the cameras never worked, or worked but were blown to bits in D-Day, or worked and were not blown to bits but were lost when the cameramen had to flee. Whatever available footage there was sent to London and edited into reels that were sent to Churchill and to Roosevelt and, to Stalin and I believe to De Gaulle. But even that footage, I would say 80 to 90% of it was suppressed because it was so bloody and so graphic that it was nothing that could ever be shown in an American movie theater. To get an idea of what that footage was, if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, the first 20 to 25 minutes of that are explicitly based on the unseen D-Day footage, because Steven Spielberg got access to that footage, which had not been seen for decades, and restored much of it. And much of the staging of that movie is based on real D-Day footage. But what most of the film was lost, and most of the film that wasn't lost wasn't shown. Yes. Yes. The first question is, did Capra ever go to the European or Pacific fronts? And the second question is, did Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, ever assist him? Capra was stationed in Washington for most of the war, but he did go to London for an extended period to work on Tunisian victory. The second chapter of that sort of horrible story is that after all of that dreadful footage by Stevens and Houston had been assembled, they were ordered to take it to London and essentially force the sequel to Tunisian Victory, which I think was called something like Africa Freed, that the British were working on. They forced that to become an Anglo-American joint venture in the interest of, you know, Allied unity. And while Capra was there successfully jamming the bad American footage down the throats of the British, he went with John Huston, who found the whole experience just terribly mortifying and stayed away as much as he could. He spent a few months in London, and was it was really important to him, because he first came to have great admiration for the resilience of the British, and also, he said very explicitly that London was where he lost any romantic ideas he had about what war was. He was, like many Londoners, he was stirred out of bed in the middle of the night a couple of times for a raid, and stood there in the freezing cold. And in his diaries from that time and in his letters home, he writes about seeing old ladies and very young children terrified that the bombs were going to drop. And Capra was in many ways a pacifist, and I think never more than after he saw that, he just was physically revolted by war, and felt that there was no choice but to continue it. So yes, his experience really shook him up in the few months that he spent in London. Theodore Geisel had a couple of very interesting roles in the war. He was an editorial cartoonist in New York. I think, I'm not remembering the paper, but I think it may have been a paper called PM, yes, which was a good leftist newspaper in New York. And Geisel was a particularly pointed anti-isolationist. A favorite target of his was Charles Lindbergh, who, you know, of course, was an infamous isolationist. And Capra and his men had spotted his work and were very impressed by him, and brought him to Los Angeles, where his first assignment was to write a series of cartoons called Private Snafu, which would be shown to GIs. They were very cheaply made, 5 to 8 minute cartoons, a series of about 20 of them. And the joke was that Private Snafu, who was visually based on Elmer Fudd, because Chuck Jones was a co-animator, was your basic army screw-up. He got everything wrong. And so each of the Snafu cartoons was a little lesson in, you know, don't tell secrets, don't eavesdrop, don't gossip, don't consort with prostitutes, watch out for malaria, make sure you get your injections. Half of the Private Snafu cartoons would end up with him getting killed as a result of not following orders. But they were very funny, very raunchy cartoons. They never could have been shown to civilians, but they were hugely popular among servicemen. And the first eight or nine of them, which were written by Geisel, are just wonderful to see because his rhythms are absolutely in place already. So it's like hearing How the Grinch Stole Christmas, but dirty and for servicemen. After that, Capra was so impressed with Geisel that he moved him off of cartoons and used him as a writer. And one of the series of films that Capra tried to make was a set of movies called Know Your Ally and Know Your Enemy. Each of the films was supposed to be about a different country, and Know Your Ally never really got off the ground, although there were some really interesting plans. You know, Janet Flanner wrote Know Your Ally France, but it was never filmed. But Know Your Enemy Italy, Know Your Enemy Japan, and Know Your Enemy Germany were the three films that were planned. Geisel worked on the script for Know Your Enemy Germany, and it was brutal. It basically said, eventually this war will end. We'll be in Germany occupying them. There'll be some sort of attempt at reconciliation. Don't trust any German ever. I mean, that was literally the message of the movie. Like many of these Capra plans, the film took so long to make that the war was over by the time it was completed. And it was converted, I think, first into a film. It was either called Here is Germany or Your Job in Germany, which was, it was sort of retrofitted as a film aimed at occupying American forces, a kind of instruction film for how to deal with Germans. And then it was re-edited again into a more entertaining short that was supposed to be shown to civilian audiences called Hitler Lives. And that short, Hitler Lives, actually won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short of the Year. So Geisel's journey through the war was a really interesting one. I'm glad you asked about that. Yes, and then I'll... the question is about whether the directors faced censorship. You're talking about the army films, not the. They did face censorship, but it wasn't censorship over the issues that Hollywood entertainment directors faced censorship over. It wasn't about nudity or sexuality or provocative language. It was about what messages were being conveyed in an individual movie. There was a particularly ridiculous case where Houston had made a really good movie called Report from the Aleutians. He had spent 3 months on a remote island in the Aleutians, which the Americans were trying to retake, and had done his first wartime documentary, which was a great documentary about, among other things, the boredom of waiting and waiting and waiting for something to happen. I think Houston and Wyler both faced instances where they recorded pilots saying things like, you know, there's flak in the air, you know, divert, go in another direction. And Army higher-ups in Washington said, oh, you can't show that. You can't show planes running away from flak, which just struck people who had actually been in these planes as the most ridiculous, kind of censorship. Like, you're supposed to imagine that pilots aren't afraid of enemy fire. It was just preposterous. But that's the kind of censorship they faced, and also the kind of censorship they often successfully fought. Sometimes they won. Yes.
Do you have any idea to how much depth people like George Marshall would have seen these films during the war and been kept really abreast of them?
The question was about how much people like George Marshall would have seen these films and been kept abreast of these films during the war. And Marshall is a really good example because more than anyone else in a position that high, he is the one who really believed in the use of film and in the use of Hollywood filmmakers during the war. Marshall had seen films used effectively as domestic propaganda during the New Deal. You know, he understood the power of film, and we should remember that sound film was only 12 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. It was still, you know, a medium that was newer to the people who were thinking about it in America now, substantially newer than the internet is to us. So it was very, very new. Marshall really understood how film could be used, and it was, in fact, his idea to bring Capra to Washington and to put him in charge of this whole program. That said, Marshall was very hands-off, as was almost everyone in the Army, about what specifically the films would be and how they would be made. It's extraordinary to me how much these filmmakers were self-starters. Capra was brought to Washington and charged with making the Why We Fight series, but they didn't particularly care what went in it. He decided what went in it. He found the screenwriters. He found the office space. He fought to get the money to do it. You know, almost anyone in a high-up position during the war had more important things to do than supervise a bunch of filmmakers. So the upside of that is that they were really left to do what they wanted. But probably the two people who were most interested in what the filmmakers were doing were Marshall and Roosevelt, who was an avid movie fan and was often used by filmmakers who wanted to go over the heads of obstructionist officers and get an okay to release their films. They would arrange a White House screening, and in at least one case, John Ford, when he was making The Battle of Midway, ordered his editor to stick in a 3-second shot of the president's son, who appeared to be at a memorial service at Midway for the soldiers killed during the battle, although it's not clear that he was ever at Midway. It's just a shot of the president's son looking somber in different light and what appears to be a different time of day from everybody else at that same service. But the president saw it. The president said, everybody in America needs to see this movie. And in fact, practically everybody in America did. By the end of its run, it was shown in 3/4 of all U.S. theaters. Yes? That is a great question for a better war historian than I am. I can tell you that MacArthur did not have a particularly active or interested role in the filmmaking program, but that's as much as I know. Yes. Yes. Right. This gentleman has remarked that one of the censorship issues was that they were not allowed to film American war dead until a film called With the Marines at Tarawa, which was one of the first films to show war dead and indisputably the best of the wartime documentaries that was not directed by one of the five guys I write about. But what you're talking about was a particularly interesting question in terms of San Pietro, because Houston really wanted to film American War Dead. He, in one of the most moving pieces of film he has, he wanted to play on the soundtrack actual interviews with young soldiers that he had recorded, had genuinely recorded on the way into San Pietro as you saw their bodies being loaded into a truck. And he was flatly denied that. And he got around it sort of inventively and appallingly simply by saying, okay, they're Italian war dead. And the army said, okay, fine. But they were American war dead in that movie. Yes. Yes, yes. MacArthur was photographed returning to the Philippines. MacArthur was very interested in film that involved MacArthur. That was a priority for him.
And I think it may have been reenacted more than once. And, you know, getting back to terror, I just want to say this. I think, and maybe incorrect in this, but that I think it was White, the Look magazine, perhaps White, that actually showed terror was in 1943. So by that time, we're already advancing in the Pacific, and the outcome of the war is already beginning to crystallize a little bit better. And I think there were still photos showing the Marine dead at Tarawa in the surf, and they're searing photographs. But they were already shown in 1943, I believe. I could be wrong, but I think that...
Magazines and newspapers were allowed to show more in still photography than filmmakers were allowed to show. One interesting thing about Tarawa is one of the strangest and least explored aspects of this decision was Marshall's decision to engage Hollywood filmmakers in this activity rather than newsreel makers. It's counterintuitive. You would think that the people who made, you know, Hearst or Pathé or March of Time newsreels would have been better qualified to go film the war than Hollywood filmmakers. Marshall did that because he wanted narratives and he wanted Hollywood's storytelling skill brought to bear on this. But Tarawa was actually made by a documentarian, a newsreel maker, and I think that is part of its power. I should say, by the way, that almost all of the movies that I'm talking about are very accessible on the internet. You can find many of them on YouTube. They're all in the public domain. So if you're curious, I urge you to take a look because they're quite impressive. Yes?
In Why We Fight, it seems that there's footage that could only be taken by the Japanese. Is that so? Is that captured film? What is it?
Yes. The question is there film in Why We Fight that could only be taken by the Japanese? Yes, and there's also film that could only have been taken by the Germans and the Italians, and that was Capra's brilliant practical solution to two things. One was that as he was preparing the Why We Fight films, he came to New York City and went to the Museum of Modern Art and saw one of the only two seized prints in the country of Leni Riefenstahl's film Triumph of the Will. And he came out of that screening saying, "We're going to lose." He was that overwhelmed by the effectiveness of German propaganda. And then, because his other big problem was that he had almost no money for these movies, Capra was given a budget of about $400,000 or $450,000 to make what he had originally planned as 52 movies. That meant it was almost impossible to shoot anything for the Why We Fight films. But the Treasury Department had seized all of these propaganda films from Germany, from Japan, and from Italy, and it was Capra's idea to turn that propaganda against the enemy propagandists, to show to American soldiers the ugliness and horror of what they were facing, and the use of those propaganda films, the appropriation of enemy propaganda in Why We Fight is a stroke of kind of formal genius that was all Capra's own. So I guess that's all the time we have for questions, but I'm happy to stick around and chat or answer questions. Thank you all very much.